Do soy foods cause cancer? Do I need to eat organic? Do I have to stop eating meat? These are all questions you are likely to be asked by patients with a recent cancer diagnosis or who are undergoing cancer treatment. Let me ask you, can you confidently answer those questions? My name is Colleen. I'm a pediatric PA and registered dietitian, and this is the Exam Room Nutrition Podcast, where each week I'm equipping you with the nutrition education you never had in school to help you be a more confident, compassionate clinician. In 2023, 1,958,310 new cancer cases and just over 609,000 cancer deaths are projected to occur in the United States, according to the American Cancer Society. Now, before you tune me out and skip this episode, even if you aren't an oncologist, the chances that you will care for a patient with cancer or one who is in remission are pretty high. You're going to want to stick around for this episode because we are unpacking some common questions about the role of nutrition in cancer prevention and treatment. There's a lot of confusion, thanks to social media influencers, around things like soy, meat, GMOs, sugar, and organic foods and their impact on cancer risk. So my guest is going to give us the facts about all of it. So get settled and join me in welcoming Julie Lanford. She's a registered dietitian and licensed nutritionist with over 15 years of experience working in oncology. She developed cancerdietitian.com in 2007, which is a healthy living website for cancer services that translates evidence-based nutrition guidelines into consumer-friendly messages for everyday life. She hosts webinars, cooking classes, and the Cancer Dietitian podcast. You can find her on Instagram at Cancer Dietitian. Julie, thank you so much for being with me today. I am so excited for this conversation. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
All right, so let's jump right in. And I'm so curious for you to actually define the role of nutrition during cancer treatment.
I find that my patients come from like this huge variety of places in terms of how they think nutrition can play a role. And so some people are on like one end where they think like they can just cure their cancer with nutrition and not do treatment. And then on the other side, people think, oh, that doesn't make any difference at all. So I always tell people, basically, we're in the middle ground, that nutrition is not a cure for cancer. So we sort of rule that one out right away. However, it is really important to help support your body. Both essentially the cancer treatments are like targeting the tumor and they have these effects on your other cells of your body, and good nutrition helps those other cells stay healthy, heal up. And then after treatment is over, nutrition is really important for you to recover more quickly, more efficiently, and more effectively. So I say the role is to support all the cells of your body. It's not a cancer treatment. It's treatment's role to target the tumor. It's nutrition's role to support your whole body.
I love that explanation. And I feel as though once there's a cancer diagnosis, nutrition kind of becomes top priority in people's minds and in people's lives. And like you said, almost sometimes to the extreme of, okay, I'm going to go, you know, gluten-free and meat-free and pesticide-free and a kind of extreme to where they've never eaten those foods before. So I love that you said it's more supportive. It's not necessarily a treatment, but it's really an adjunct to the treatment that you're getting for your cancer. So yep. I also love your approach to helping people understand foods that they can eat as opposed to ones that they can't, because this is huge, whether it's in cancer treatment or, you know, weight management. People so often focus on, you can't have this, don't eat this. But why do you think that position is important?
The thing is, someone gets diagnosed with cancer, they often don't have a treatment plan for 2 weeks, maybe a month. Maybe they're in sort of this watch and wait type of treatment. And eating is something you can control. And so what I find is that for some people, they sort of latch on to their nutrition or their, you know, diet plan as something they can actually do right now. And they go overboard. They tend to do a little too much internet research and believing of maybe non-credentialed people. And then they start down this path that's sort of negative, that, you know, can't have, can't have, can't have, which I think, you know, from a mental health standpoint, it's just depressing to live that way of all the things you can't have, or thinking that food is somehow going to be toxic, or that there's something you're going to eat that's like going to majorly cause some kind of problem in your body. And that's very fear-based, I think. And especially when you're facing a cancer diagnosis, you want to have as positive attitude as is possible, given, you know, the situation that you're in. And I also fully believe that what you do eat is far much more important than what you don't eat. So keying in on, well, what are the nutrients that your body really needs to function at its best? And when we think about those things, and I always say you start including all the things that your body really needs and that hopefully also taste good to you, then, you know, the other things just kind of fall to the side. And there's not anything that people could absolutely never have. I don't have a list of foods you should never eat. It's about how you balance those in. But I do have lists of foods that I think you should include, you know, regularly. So that's why, to me, someone's relationship with food, like their mental relationship with food, is even more important than the actual food they eat. And so we want to kind of frame our nutrition plan within the context of a positive relationship with food. And I, of course, come from science-based background. So then we focus on, well, what does the science say? And then try to tease out, well, what does this person actually like to eat? You know, so that we can fill those sort of nutritious buckets with foods that they really like to eat. And that way, eating is a very positive experience. Whenever possible. Obviously, during cancer treatment, there are times when you can't eat the foods you love because they don't taste right or you just physically cannot eat. And so we're always troubleshooting with that. But in general, especially for people who aren't having nutrition-related side effects, you know, eating as nutritiously as possible during treatment is pretty important. And it also helps after treatment.
I think that's such an important point for all clinicians to carry with them when they are educating and talking to their patients about nutrition. Is we sometimes focus so much on, okay, don't eat fried foods. You can't have milkshakes. Don't have this. And we do give them a list of, you know, no foods, or these are the quote unquote bad foods. But I love your approach to talk about the foods that we can eat and that we should be eating. So before we actually go into kind of our rapid fire cancer nutrition questions, I would love for you to give us that list that you had said of those foods that patients should be focusing on and the ones that have that big green check mark that they should prioritize, just as kind of a key overview for our listeners.
Yeah. So first of all, if a clinician's working with a patient during treatment, I mean, bottom line, we want them to eat. Eat anything is better than eating nothing. So this sort of list that I'm going to talk through is mainly for people. So either they're in a treatment regimen that really isn't going to cause them problems with eating, they're not losing lots of weight, or they're done with treatment and they're kind of moving into their survivorship phase of life. So generally, anything's better than nothing. Get as many calories and protein as someone can during treatment. And then if they're doing well, the things that I think are really important, first of all, we do recommend a plant-based diet. That does not mean vegan. Okay. So in the health world, of course, you know, plant-based means mostly plants. So that's what I talk to people about, is why mostly plants. Plants have lots of great nutrients. So I key in on fruits and vegetables, like ideally 4 to 5 cups every day of fruits and vegetables that's combined. I don't care if they eat more fruits, they eat more vegetables, whatever. But we want lots of fruits and vegetables, plant-based proteins at least once a day. So even if they're meat eaters, that's fine. But having nuts, beans, or seeds once a day is helpful from a fiber standpoint, from a plant food standpoint, and from a nutrition standpoint. I like whole grains regularly. So doesn't have to be 100% of the time, but whole grains are really important. Getting fluids, and that could be unsweet tea, unsweet coffee, you know, whatever, flavored water, or just good old plain water. Finding ways for people to get fluids that they enjoy. And that's kind of like the big key. And then fill in with the things that maybe they really want.
I love that. And that's some great tips that my general practitioners can take into their clinic when patients are asking, hey, what can I eat or what should I eat? Focusing on those few things that Julie had suggested is a really great place to start. And thanks for giving us that clarification on kind of specifically the patient that we're talking about. Cancer treatment is complicated, and that's why there's dietitians like you who do specialize in it. So I'm thankful that you said that the patients that we're speaking to are not, you know, in the middle of cancer treatment and are unable to tolerate any foods, or who are losing weight and we're having issues with that. Those patients, you definitely need to be working with a registered dietitian like yourself who specializes in oncology. But for the general cancer patient who is either outside of treatment or right after treatment or even before treatment, these are great tips that you can be suggesting to them. So thanks for just pointing that out, that that's who our target patient would be. All right. So I'm really excited for this next segment in our show because we're going to do some rapid fire nutrition, most common questions that you guys might be getting from your patients about cancer and the effects of food. So come back to me. If you're multitasking, you're definitely going to want to listen to this next section. So let's get to it, Julie. So number one, does sugar feed cancer?
So short answer is no, but the nuance is, well, okay, yeah, because sugar feeds every cell of our body, but you can't pick or choose which cell gets what fuel. So that's generally what I encourage people is that this is the number one myth. I mean, 15 years in oncology nutrition, and it hasn't gone away. So yes, that to me is a red flag. If somebody asks that question, they're reading something that's not evidence-based.
So I think a follow-up to that question would be, should cancer patients avoid simple starches? So I'm thinking the sweets like donuts and cupcakes and cookies and sugar sweetened drinks. What are your thoughts on those types of foods when people talk and think about sugar?
No, they don't have to avoid them. They are like every other, you know, person that should find a healthy balance.
So then the next question would be, now that we're beyond sweets, when people look up sugar, right now we've got this whole craze on social media about like fruit is bad because it has high sugar, which is completely false. And those people that you're following are not nutrition professionals at all. But when our patients are Googling this, they're seeing that, you know, those types of foods are bad for you. And then they're coming and asking if we should follow a low carb or a keto diet. So how do we answer that question?
I say, no, I'm not a fan because there's lots of nutritious foods with carbohydrates, fruits, whole grains, dairy, and I don't like diets that eliminate entire food groups. So we want people to eat whole grains, we want people to eat fruit, and we want people to have, find a balance with some of those, you know, sweet foods.
Great answer. And I completely agree. It drives me insane when I see people telling patients to stop eating fruit because it has high sugar and it's going to cause diabetes. And it's so frustrating because they're not thinking about, okay, well, an apple has so many other nutritious micronutrients and fiber and so many great things that now you're having your patients completely avoid that. And they're probably not even eating enough fruit. I'm so glad that you clarified that, you know, carbs are not the enemy and that we need to be eating that. And I think that's a great framework to follow for clinicians is to never avoid complete food groups. That is just a red flag and you need to stop recommending that to your patients in as a general guideline. Okay, question number three is a big one and it's been around for years. I mean, I remember researching this when I was in college and that was more than 10 years ago. So do soy foods cause cancer?
No. So the sort of the current party line on the soy foods is that whole soy is perfectly fine. And it's the isoflavones or the phytoestrogens that we're really focused on, but we've now pretty much cleared them. They're like perfectly healthy. The initial concern was because of the studies that were done like in rodents and they metabolize soy differently than humans do. So the current recommendation is whole soy foods is fine. If people are having processed soy where the isoflavones may be concentrated, then that might be something to kind of be cautious with because we don't have research on that piece. But more, even more recently, I have finally seen oncologists like coming back around and telling maybe the patients who they told years ago to avoid soy, finally letting go. Even though us oncology dietitians have been like, we're pretty sure soy is just fine. We have great human studies showing it's fine. So yeah, it's great. It's nutritious. It's a plant food. It's a legume. So we want people to eat, you know, the nutritious versions of the soy.
Okay. So for my nutrition newbies, can you give us some unprocessed soy foods or the natural ones versus the ones that haven't been studied?
I think generally, is it a soy pill? Is it a soy powder? And is it a some kind of processed like breakfast or protein bar that's using isolated soy protein? Otherwise, tofu, soy milk, tempeh, soybeans, soy nuts, you know, edamame, all those are perfectly natural. Basically, you're getting the concentration of this particular phytonutrient in the form as it was grown in the plant.
Super helpful. And soy milk is a really big one, actually, in the pediatric world, because for the parents who don't want to do whole milk, they'll sometimes ask about, you know, almond milk. And I actually suggest soy if they really are like, absolutely no, because soy is more closely related to the nutrients in the whole milk. Almond milk is nothing.
Nothing. So I know. People ask me, well, what if I don't want, or they can't for whatever reason do, you know, cow milk? And I'm like, soy, honestly, is your best alternative. If you don't like that, well, you're going to have to really read labels. But at least it's, yeah, it's an okay substitute.
Okay. Number four, our next question is, do I need to eat organic during treatment, and or does organic prevent cancer? So it's kind of a two question in one.
No and no. I mean, if somebody wants to eat organic, they can. I always say there's no human studies that have shown that eating organic food promotes better health outcomes, and the pesticide residues that are on conventionally grown produce are really, really, really tiny, very limited. You know, they have controls over how pesticides can be sprayed. And a lot of organic farmers use pesticides. It's just organically approved, which may or may not be any safer than conventional. So what I tell people is, I don't care whether you eat organic or not. I'm not saying don't eat organic. You can if you want to. Like, you might have your favorite farmer and they're happen to be organic farmer. Great. But what matters most is that people eat produce. And if somebody says, well, I'm not going to eat it because it's not organic, and then they don't eat produce, like, that's not good. But I do often have to kind of talk people through this because they assume that conventional is like subpar produce. And it's not. It's just, you know, it's just as nutritious for you. If you prefer organic, that's fine. And you can find it or you have the resources, but don't let that be sort of a hard line of what you will or won't eat.
I completely agree with you. And I think, again, the social media push for organic foods is actually more detrimental than it is helpful because, you know, inflation is insane right now and it's difficult enough for the majority of families to buy produce in general.
Yeah.
And now if you're putting that burden and that pressure on them to say that, well, hey, that vegetable and that fruit that you bought is not as nutritious as an organic one, that's really frustrating. And I feel like challenging for them if now they feel like they have to buy organic when it's already difficult enough to buy and provide fruits and vegetables for your family.
And that's not even true.
Right.
So it's not fair to say that, put that extra burden on people when it's not even true.
You're right. Okay. Talk to me about GMOs. This is another huge one that social media influencers love to talk about. So is there any literature on GMOs and cancer? And can our patients eat these things? Do we need to be afraid of them?
I do not think we need to be afraid of them. I think we need to be thankful for them because they really can provide like tools for especially other parts of the world where they have serious malnutrition that genetically modified plants can provide better nutrition for people who really need it. So I don't have any trouble with GMOs. All the research, the National Science Foundation, the National Academy of Sciences, I mean, over 1,000 studies they've looked at regarding genetically engineered foods is not showing any problem. And on top of all of that, there's really only 10, I think, or 11 crops in the US that are approved for GMOs. So it's also kind of stupid because lots of things get labeled non-GMO. There is no GMO option, you know? So it becomes this marketing thing where you pay more for something that's really no different. So I think people are mainly afraid of it because they don't understand it. They don't understand why it's needed. They don't understand how it works and that it's really not that scary. But what I tell people is if it does bother you and it just makes you like uncomfortable, I say the same thing with soy. If it bothers you, it makes you uncomfortable. You don't have to eat soy foods. You don't have to eat GMO products. Find out what 10 or 11 there are. And then you can, you know, sometimes they're labeled non-GMO, but if something's organic, it's inherently non-GMO. So you can buy the organic version of those particular things if that's, you know, kind of the place you are. But sometimes for people, you know what, if you just have this thing and it's really bothering you and you can figure out a way around it so that it just lowers your anxiety around the food, I'm all in support of that. But that doesn't mean that your neighbor or your friend has to do it the same way.
Great point. And I love that you said that it's a marketing thing that some foods that are labeled non-GMO are naturally non-GMO. So they're just getting you to buy it. It's kind of like when they put like cholesterol free on like a broccoli package, you're kind of like, well, yay,
Or fat-free chocolate sauce. That always like, I was like, yeah. there's never any fat in the chocolate sauce. Fat-free chocolate
it
sauce.
It is. It's okay. Just a marketing thing to get you to buy stuff. So, okay. Super helpful. Let's talk about, is raw food better than cooked food?
Nope. They're different. I say, you know what? The cooking process deactivates some nutrients. It activates some nutrients. So sometimes you eat food raw. Sometimes you eat it cooked. Here in North Carolina, people love their tomato sandwiches in the summer. That's with raw tomatoes. We also love tomato sauce in, you know, spaghetti. So I just encourage people to get a variety. You do not have to eat only raw food. And just because it's cooked doesn't mean that it has zero nutrition.
Yeah. I see reels almost every day on Instagram about some influencer boiling, you know, their broccoli, and they're saying that it's not nutritious at all anymore. And you need to just eat raw broccoli. And I'm like, oh my goodness. It's not palatable either. I mean, some people don't really enjoy raw vegetables. So I love that we're clearing up the air on a lot of these things, because I feel as though social media and even patients kind of Googling just complicate things for themselves unnecessarily. So I think the gist of what you're saying is kind of eat what you enjoy and try to have a well-balanced diet with a variety of foods. I mean, that keeps it in the most basic level. And I think that's the easiest way that we can help steer our patients toward longevity and towards optimal health. Okay. Should I avoid meat? That's a big one.
No, unless you want to. I mean, I'm totally fine with people being vegan or vegetarian, but most people are not interested in that. And there's no reason you should avoid meat. The typical American probably overdoes it on their protein. So I often think people could cut back their meat portions, but there's no solid reason why meat itself is a problem. It's an efficient form of protein. You probably don't need as much protein as you actually think you do. And so including meat can be handy, helpful, tasty for many people. So there's nothing wrong with it. But if somebody prefers not to have it, that's also a fine choice.
I love that. So helpful. And I talk about protein all the time on this podcast, because there's also confusion about how much protein people should be eating, whether it's pediatric world or in the weight management world. People think they need a lot more protein than they actually need. Okay. And then also, you know, this is a protein source, but should I be avoiding dairy?
Nope. Unless you want to, or you don't tolerate it, or you just don't like it. Dairy is another great source of protein and lots of other nutrients. Of course, everyone knows it has calcium, but there's no reason to avoid it. There are some documentaries and some books that will tell you dairy is a problem. And, you know, for prostate cancer, they had some research, but generally, you know, the recommendation, even in the US, at 3 servings a day of dairy, I think that's a piece to look at. If people love dairy products, they might be going over 3 a day, which I think they're missing other foods if they're eating that much dairy. But I do not think anyone needs to completely avoid dairy.
It's a great point. And I love dairy. So if a clinician told me you can't have any dairy and I'm going through cancer treatment, not only am I dealing with the psychological impact of the cancer diagnosis and the impacts of a treatment, but now you're taking away one of my favorite foods, and that provides me comfort. So I think this is such an important conversation. And I love how you're answering them as if you don't like dairy, you don't have to have it. If you love dairy, stay within the guidelines and enjoy it. All right. So one of our last ones is talking about supplements and herbs. And, you know, there's a lot of supplements and a lot of herbal remedies out there for cancer and cancer prevention and treatment. So if our patients come in and ask, hey, are there any supplements that I need to be taking, or should I be taking XYZ herb? What does the literature say on that?
Basically, no. Generally, all the evidence is like, they're not helpful. Sometimes they can be harmful if you're taking too much, especially during treatment. They don't want people taking high dose antioxidant supplements, because that can basically negatively counteract the treatments you're having. And the American Institute for Cancer Research has an evidence-based guideline not to use supplements or herbs for cancer prevention or risk reduction. I think there is obviously a use for supplements, and that's when you have a low level of something. So the nice thing about people during treatment is they're getting lab work all the time. So if your lab work is low in something, you probably will need to take a supplement. And a lot of people are low in vitamin D. There is some, you know, research showing that cancer survivors have more incidence of low vitamin D. So, I mean, I do encourage people to have their vitamin D checked. So PCPs, for sure, that could be something that they regularly do with their cancer survivor clients is, okay, how's their vitamin D level? If they're really fatigued, which is a very common side effect from cancer treatment, is their iron low? Like, what does their full iron panel look like? Not just hemoglobin and hematocrit. We're talking like, look at an iron panel, their ferritin stores, and is there something that needs to be done for that? Is there potassium low? Those types of things, which usually oncologists are kind of monitoring. But I think once they're done with treatment, they're not going to the oncologist that much. And they really should be going back to the PCP. And it is a big deal for the PCP to monitor that.
Now, I wanted to stress the point here. We're not talking about a cancer patient who's losing weight. Now, obviously, we might need an oral replacement shake.
Right.
And that would be, you know, at the discretion of you, the dietitian, because there is a place for those. But ideally, we are looking for individuals to get their nutrient needs from whole foods.
Yeah. And when I say supplement, I kind of mean pill. So yes, the nutrition supplement drinks like Boost and Ensure, there's Orgain, there's like a lot of different versions now, or even store brand, Carnation Instant Breakfast. Those are all very useful for people in treatment who can't eat. Those are great. Perfect. Yes, you might need them. But when I say no to supplements, I'm meaning like supplement pills.
Yeah. Yeah. And I totally agree with you with that as well too. And I think that piece for PCPs about, you know, vitamin D and iron levels was super important, because don't just assume because your patient has a cancer diagnosis that once they're done with treatment, they're still getting labs and stuff done with the oncologist, because sometimes they're not. So I think that was a really important reminder for my primary care clinicians to be paying attention and making sure you're doing those annual labs, because those are really key components.
Yes. And you know what else oncologists do not like to manage is blood sugars. So if your PCP and your patient has diabetes, or maybe they were on the fence and then they went over for cancer treatment, which often involves like steroids and weight gain and like less movement and like all the factors that we think, okay, might push them over, the PCP is going to be the one who's going to need to check on that and manage that, because oncologists are generally like, I treat the cancer, and if their blood sugars are a little high, that's not my problem.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I want to linger here a little bit, because some of my listeners might be thinking of somewhat of a hot topic right now. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on a probiotic supplement, and if that's beneficial, should our patients be doing that, or what are your thoughts on that?
I do not think the supplements are that helpful unless like you've been in the hospital, you have C. diff, and like, you know, they are discharging you with probiotics, or they're treating you with probiotics in the hospital. Like, I think if someone needs probiotic supplements, there should be a clinical reason. And ideally, they're getting like prescription strength, or they're being told a specific kind to get and being told where to get it and the brand, because it's just like a free for all. So you could be paying for probiotics that aren't really actually going to help you. But across the board, I prefer people eat probiotic foods and prebiotic foods to support good gut health, which is going to be like all the things that we already talked about are good for you. But in general, no, I don't think people need probiotic supplements. I think they can eat a good, nutritious diet to promote good gut health.
Yes, I love that answer. And I'm all for suggesting whole foods instead of a pill, because who really knows what you're digesting and absorbing in that pill? You would get far more benefits from eating probiotic foods instead of just taking it in pill form. Okay, the last supplement I wanted to ask your opinion on is a fiber supplement like Metamucil or any of those other ones, Benefiber, that you can get from the store. What are your thoughts on that?
If you're already doing it in food, you're already drinking lots of fluids, you're already being physically active, like you're doing all the things that will support good bowel movements, and it's not enough, and you're still kind of constipated is what we would be looking at, then I suggest a psyllium supplement. And so Metamucil is psyllium. But the other thing with constipation, I think a lot of people don't realize, is that it may be an anatomy issue and a muscular issue. And so pelvic floor physical therapy can be something, if somebody has a lot of constipation issues that aren't resolved with lifestyle, I think pelvic floor physical therapy is something that they might ask for. And that's something a lot of PCPs should know, when pelvic floor physical therapy would be beneficial.
Great answer. I love how you think outside the box as well too, because as clinicians, we really need to be thinking whole person and lifestyle, not just honing in on here's a pill. Let's think outside the box and what else can we do to provide relief for our patients. All right. My final and favorite question that I always ask most of my guests is, what advice is the worst cancer nutrition advice that you've heard or your patients have told you that their doctors have said that you want to just shout on the rooftops to all clinicians to please stop telling their patients?
Okay, you're not going to believe it. Please stop telling them to lose weight. Like, in general, it drives me crazy, the whole culture around weight and health. But on top of that, you take somebody who's just faced a life-threatening disease, who went through serious treatment, you know, that's like, no, the first thing they need to do is not lose weight. Now, yes, I think that they need positive health behaviors in their life, but just focusing on weight, I don't think weight's a great outcome to necessarily focus on. So, I mean, if we could stop talking about the weight, people already feel bad enough about it, especially if they've gained weight during treatment, they're already feeling bad enough. They've had parts of their bodies removed. They have like horrible body image. Telling them to lose weight is not helpful. So I prefer talk to them about positive health behaviors, what gives their life meaning, so that they can get realistic fitness activities and nutritious eating that supports their dreams. Maybe they don't care to lose weight, so don't bother looking at it. But if they do, try to refocus them over onto the health behaviors rather than just the scale outcome, because it's so hard and weight is not necessarily something we can control. And we want a positive relationship with food. And like, who knows how much longer they're going to live? Let's help them live for their dreams and not for shrinking their body.
What an amazing way to end this interview. That was so encouraging and impactful. And I'm just so grateful that you shared your knowledge and your expertise with me. I've learned so much from you, and I know my listeners really learned a lot from you. Thank you so much for this gift of your time. I can't give this time back to you. So I'm so grateful, Julie. Thank you again for being here with me.
This was so fun. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, now it's time for my nutrition notes. So I wanted to provide you guys with some information about what organic means, because I know this is a really hot topic in social media and in just general population today. So I think there's some confusion around organic being better, being healthier, and pesticides that are used. So I wanted to give you some clarification on the definitions of what organic actually is, and then my final thoughts on if your patients should be consuming organic foods. So I took this directly from the USDA's website. And so their definition of what organic actually means is, organic products must be produced using agricultural production practices that foster resource cycling, promote ecological balance, maintain and improve soil and water quality, minimize the use of synthetic materials, and conserve biodiversity. So there are actually four different labels of organic. And this is an important point, because if your patients think that they're purchasing an organic product because it says organic on it, it might not fully be 100% organic. So there are some differences. So I wanted to explain the different labels that patients might be seeing and what exactly they mean. So for something to say 100% organic and it has that label USDA organic on it, it will have that organic seal. So that is legally allowed for them to place it on there. It is 100% certified organic. It has 100% certified organic ingredients and processing. And there is a certifying agency that will go out and certify this farm or this specific place. It is non-GMO. All ingredients comply with the natural list of allowed and prohibited substances. For something to say organic, right? So it's not 100% organic. It just says organic. The organic USDA seal is allowed. 95% of the ingredients are certified organic. So it's not 100%, it's only 95% organic. It's non-GMO. It has non-organic ingredients that comply with the national list, and certification is also required. So those are going to be the two most strict forms of certification for organic. For a food that says made with organic, the organic seal is not allowed. It is legally not allowed. So it can say made with organic, but it cannot have the USDA organic seal. It must specify in the ingredients list which ingredients are organic. And it means that at least 70% of the ingredients are certified organic. It is non-GMO, however, and the non-organic ingredients comply with the national list, and certification is also required for this. If a product says organic ingredients, then the USDA organic seal is not allowed. The product cannot be described as organic. There's not really any specific percent of certified organic ingredients. It might contain GMOs, and compliance with the national list is not required, and certification is not required. So patients thinking that they're buying organic, if it says organic ingredients, they could be buying something that has 1% organic ingredient. So there's no benefit, but they're probably having a significant cost increase with that item. So are organic foods healthier or better for patients? The answer is no. Just like Julie had said, if your patients want to buy organic and they have the financial means to do so, that's fine. Let them. That's perfectly fine. That's how they want to feed themselves and feed their families. Go for it. But if patients don't, and this is a financial burden to them to be seeking organic foods, remove them from that burden, because organic is not inherently healthier. An organic apple and a regular apple, it still has the same nutrients in it. So provide reassurance to your patients that it's okay if they can't buy organic. They're still getting really nutritious foods from the general produce, and it's not a subpar produce item. But if they can afford organic, that's fine too. But those labels are really, really important to be aware of, because there are guidelines and there are standards that must be met. So making sure that if a patient wants organic, that they are actually looking for the USDA organic seal, because those ones comply with the certification. So I hope this information was helpful for you and that you learned a little bit about organic food and cancer nutrition. If you want to hang out with me, you can find me on Instagram at Exam Room Nutrition, and I would love to connect with you. I'm just so grateful that you choose to listen to my podcast, and I really hope to be continuing to put out really helpful, useful information. So please let me know if there's some content that you want me to cover. As always, let's continue to make our patients healthier, one exam room at a time. I'll see you next time.